What I'm trying to do both today and tomorrow, you know, I'm not really an expert. I just do it. And so what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to provoke and encourage you in terms of evangelism in the local church, because I believe that's primarily where evangelism is done or should be done. And when I say I'm not an expert, I'm reminded of, I was speaking once in the States, and this guy came up to me afterwards, and he just said, "I really enjoy listening to you and Tim Keller." And I went, "Yeah, right, different league, he is." And he went, "Yeah, he is." He was unusually blunt for... He's an unusually blunt for an American. And he said, "Yeah, he is." He said, "You know," he says, "when I hear him, I think, I thank the Lord he's on our side." And I said, "Exactly." And he says, "When I hear you, I think, I could do that." So he meant it as a compliment. So that's what I think about in terms of Don Carson. So basically, what I want you to do is I want you to go away from here and think, that was wrong. I could do that. I want you to be stimulated to get some ideas and some encouragement. And I think most of all, do you know what happens to us? We get worn down so that we lose our passion. My best evangelists are people who've just been converted because they've got that passion. And I think for myself so many times, you know, where's that passion gone? So we're doing this the wrong way around in one sense. We're going to look at the local church first of all, and then tomorrow we're going to look at impacting the culture. And I do stress again, I'm not really an expert in this. I just do it. I went to Robert Murray McShane's church, which was great. You know, seats 900 people. 7 people were in it. 4 of them left when I went there. It's that unifying effect that I tend to have upon people. And, you know, you think, what do you do? What do you do? And now people come and say, what did you do? What did you do? Give us the program. And Mike was right in this. There isn't a silver bullet in the sense of one program, especially in a postmodern culture, which is anti-programmatic. And I think we're always looking for a program, and I don't think we should look for a program. But equally, for me, it's like playing darts. I throw 12 darts at the board, and I expect 2 or 3 to stick. And in terms of evangelism, what's happened gradually over the years is we're finding more and more of them are sticking. You know, it's that first surprise you get when you stand up and you tell someone the gospel and they say, well, I'd like to believe this. I'd like to become a Christian. And as a good Scots Calvinist, you're going, no, that's not right. No. It's got to be more difficult than that. You know, there's something wrong here. You know, get thee behind me, Satan, or something. You know, and yet, we shouldn't be surprised at how it happens. So I think, just in terms of the church, and we are going to look at this more tomorrow, but you've got to think of the context in which you're evangelizing. Because, you know, we'd love to be evangelizing in a revival situation, or we'd love to be evangelizing in, you know, some people speak as though they'd love to be evangelizing in the 17th century. I'm not sure it was any easier then. But I do feel that there's almost a tendency especially amongst Reformed people, to be a wee bit depressed about evangelism. It's the day of small things thing. And also, I did feel sorry for the Yorkshire people yesterday. I don't think Yorkshire's that hard. I've been to Yorkshire, and it's just... I think Yorkshire people are great to tell the gospel because they're just straight up. And I think in every culture, you can find links that you can tell the gospel. I still believe that the gospel still works. When I went to St. Peter's, the hardest thing I had to do was persuade the handful of people that the gospel still worked, not just in the first century, not just in the 16th century, and not just in China or in the Baptist church down the road, but that the gospel actually worked here now. If your people believed that, then there'd be no problem in inviting people to church. I think most of our people don't, in their heart of hearts, really believe it. And so, in essence, and for me, what I'm doing all the time is I'm preaching the gospel to myself. So we think about what kind of culture we are in, says he. This works, yeah. So a traditional culture, a modern, postmodern, post-postmodern, all that kind of stuff. Right, you can overanalyze. But the simplest thing to do is go and listen to people. So we had an American missionary come over to Dundee, and he was saying, right, what do I do? And I said, okay, first of all, forget evangelism explosion, forget all the programs, forget the fact that you think you can do it. You haven't a hope. You cannot do it. And he kind of looked at me with that, you know, crestfallen. I'm American. We can do everything. And I was going, no, you can't. You can't do it. I said, I'm Scottish. We definitely can't do it, and you can't do it either. He said, well, what do you want me to do? I said, you know what I want you to do? In a year's time, I'm going to walk down this street, which is called the Perth Road, and if I walk into any coffee shop and any member of staff doesn't know your name, you're fired. You're going home. And he said, you want me to drink coffee for Jesus? And I said, yes, I do. He said, that's my dream job. I said, well, you've got... I said, you've got it. Because, I mean, some of you, you'll think, this is just so simple. You know, I'm a minister, I preach the gospel, but I had to have up on my study wall for a long time, I had a poster that said, you can't talk to people about Jesus unless you're talking to people. You know, you can't go out and hand out people tracts and preach if you never, ever talk to people. It's why you don't buy flowers off Interflora. You go to the florist. It's why you go and get your newspaper from the same shop. You're speaking to people. It's why it's just that connection with people. But also, you consider the culture that you're in. So you need to read. You do not come and read all the stuff that you'd like to read about an ideal society. You read your local newspaper. You try and grasp what's going on in the culture. And in our culture today in Britain, newspapers are generally useless now for that. They're largely advertising magazines for the middle classes. You need to, there's magazines like The Spectator, which I read, and Private Eye. You can tap into good blogs and different things, but you need to try and understand where the culture is at. My son's doing a church plant in the poorest housing estate in Dundee, which makes it one of the poorest in Scotland. We're the poorest city in Scotland. And his methodologies, I love what he's doing. He's going to live in the community, and he got on the community council, and he just goes and sits and talks to people and meets people. And I think that's really, really important. So you've got to find out what kind of culture your church is part of. You ask, what do the people in your culture live for? And again, please don't presuppose that. You can't get that from a book. You know, I always love it when someone comes and says, I've got a real heart for Scotland and I love the Scottish people. Have you ever met any? No, but I read about them and I've seen Braveheart. No, that's like saying I'm going to evangelize Torquay by watching Dad's Army. It doesn't work. So you've got to find out, what do people actually live for? Like, one of the things I didn't know was how many young people in my community live for computer games. To me, that's nuts. But that's where so many of them are at. So you ask that question. How do you find out? I think that's very interesting. I do think listening to people and talking to people and just wandering around. We have one car because we're not FIEC pastors, we're Presbyterians, we're very poor, and I like you millionaires, and you know, you prosperity gospel people. And so my wife works about 30 miles away from home, and the church is two miles from my home, and I said, well, look, why don't you cycle to work? It'll do you good. It'll save the gym, you know, but she wasn't buying that for some reason. So I started walking to work. You know this. I couldn't, after I did it for about 2 weeks, I was thinking, you complete idiot. Why didn't you do this before? Because I walk through the middle of the city, and I know all the buildings. You meet the same people often when you're walking. And, you know, you do the prayer walking and everything. And it's just wonderful. And then you say, well, it's 45 minutes wasted. No, it's not, because you've got a podcast as well you can listen to. So that's a Sinclair Ferguson sermon, at least one point of it. And so, you know, you can get a huge amount. But you find out. Find out by walking. Find out by talking. Find out by listening. I would argue that one of the primary parts of evangelism is actually listening to where people are at. How do people cope with the worries of life? In my area, a lot of it is drugs, and a bigger amount is alcohol. Escapism, you know, just listening to where people are at, just asking that questions. What do they think of God and the church, and what do they think of our church? Now, I'm not a big fan of questionnaires, especially if they're done dishonestly. You know, the dishonest ones, it's what the Jehovah's Witness do. They turn up at your door, or they used to, now they're just at the railway station, but with a booklet saying, would you like to pass your driving test? And then by the time you get to page 10 is, would you like to live forever on planet Earth? To which the sensible answer, not very Christian, is, not with you lot, no thanks. But there are Christians who say, we're going to do a questionnaire, and it's a means of telling the gospel. No, that's dishonest. To me, that breaches 2 Corinthians 4. We don't handle the word of God dishonestly. We don't manipulate. You do a questionnaire because you want to find out the answers. And we did one not long after we went into St. Peter's and around the place, and we thought our area was predominantly student and so on. And we did a questionnaire, and we discovered that a quarter of our area was old age pensioners, a quarter of our area was young families, and a significant proportion of our area was drug addicts. And only a quarter was students. And that changed the way that we looked at things. So we did, for example, an old folks club. We didn't call it that, we called it MAC, Mature Adults Club. But you've got to look and consider your area. And if you've done it from 20 years ago, you need to do it again, because most of us are in areas where there's considerable change occurring. And also, you can ask what they think. One of the key things we found was, instead of asking, you know, would you like to believe in God, I would ask, do you believe in God? And, you know, we would have some questions like that. But instead of inviting them to church, one of the things we did, we said, what do you think the church could do for you? Now, one of the big advantages we have is we have a building that's very prominent in the community. So people think we're a proper church, not a sect or a cult. And by the way, I mean, I know in some places this works, but all you guys who think, well, we're just going to, you know, sit in coffee shops and have latte gospel conversations. In working class communities, they just think you're weird. You know, come round to my house and have a coffee. Oh, what kind of pervert are you? You know, whereas in actual having a church building, for a lot of people, that's actually, I mean, and if you've got a building, our building was an enormous disadvantage until we realized, A, the location was fantastic, and B, what we could do with it. So you maximize the use of your building. But you ask people what they think. I've not often done door-to-door, but I do actually quite enjoy it, and we do it at Christmas when we give out about 2,000 Christmas cards in the area. We just do it consistently, and over the years, we've seen a drip, drip, drip effect. A lot of what you're doing in evangelism is breaking up the ground, by the way. I'm a farm boy, so I think in terms of plowing and sowing and reaping, and a lot of what we've got to do in our culture is plowing, and we do that with the Christmas cards. But I remember one door-to-door time I was going out, and sometimes you absolutely dreaded it, and sometimes it was great, and this time it was great. I knocked on a door, and this lady came to the door, and she said, I said, well, hi, we're from the local church. She says, oh, no, no, we're Jehovah's Witnesses. So I held up my Bible and went, revenge! And she slammed the door in my face, you know, so I thought, okay, Jehovah's Witnesses don't have a sense of humor, that proves my point. You know, whether you could, you will have some people who are very gifted at just speaking to people off the blue, but most of us, it's not that. What kind of church can reach out? Because here's the problem. It's not just going out and doing evangelism. I do a lot of evangelism. But here's the problem. I'm telling people to come and see. Now, I realize that it's kind of an in thing to say, oh, evangelism is not inviting people to church. I don't agree. Because where will people meet Jesus? I do a lot of cafe evangelism. And if I do it for different churches, I don't care the denomination. I always say, when I'm done, I want to be able at the end to say, see that person there, see that woman there, see that man there. You go to their church on Sunday and you'll meet Jesus. That's why I don't do evangelism with liberal churches. I do them in liberal churches, but not with them. Because I had friends who, when I became a Christian, went to liberal churches and they thought I was mad. And I agreed with them. If I believed what a liberal church believes, I would be mad. What a waste of a life. But the gospel, I want them to not just hear the gospel being preached, but to see the gospel in action. And I think, honestly, in our culture, I think the church is both the worst apologetic for the gospel in some ways, but also the best. And so, personally, I mean, we have a lot of students, and they'll say when they leave, you know, can you recommend a church? I never recommend the denomination, not even my own. I say simply, you know, looking for a church where Christ is honored, where his word is proclaimed, where it's sought to be practiced. And then for me, this is an absolute. If you couldn't invite your friends to your church, don't go to it. What's the point? because you want people to become believers, to become Christians. And I think, so you, bizarrely, if you're thinking about doing outreach, you've got to think about inreach first. You've got to think about where the church is at. And I'm suggesting certain things. A church needs to be real. We live in a plastic age, which often breeds plastic Christians. We've got to reach out, but we've got to have something to bring them to, something concrete. And you might say, well, I'm bringing them to Jesus. No, you're not. What do you mean by that? How do they know what Jesus is? How do they know who Jesus is? What does it mean? The bride of Christ is his church, and there the beauty of Christ should be seen even more than in the beauty of the creation. And that's what you've got to ask. So it's got to be a real. Your church has got to be real. People have got to come in and go, truly God is amongst you. It cannot be fake. It cannot be plastic. And I think we do the plastic stuff all the time. And, you know, we all do it. I think we've got to be radical. You can tell my brethren background, I like alliteration. Radical means going back to the roots. And I think we've got to think about what that is. It's tied in with the reality. Christian conversion changes everything. We have a new outlook on everything, a new attitude, a new motivation, a new relationship to everyone. And I think, I mean, here's for me a very simple principle. You will never, ever grow your church unless you're prepared to lose people. And especially in a smaller church, there's the tyranny of the dominant family, which many of you will have faced. And what they basically say is, if you do this, I'll leave. To which the correct response is, bye. Because you cannot allow people to restrict your freedom to proclaim the gospel. Now, you're not constantly changing things. It's not about you. It's not. But too many of us are working in an environment where we're trying to keep the people that we've got, or worse still, trying to attract Christians from other churches. So let me give you an example. A guy from London phones me up. We're doing a church plant in St. Andrews. And we're breaking old. I didn't know there were rules, but apparently there are rules about church planting. I haven't done the courses, so I don't know. But we just decided to do one. And we went and investigated, decided there was a need, and so on. And we didn't really have a core group. We didn't have anything like that. And this guy said, I believe God's calling me to come and work in St. Andrews, me and my family. So I, being a little bit Highland mystical, stroke charismatic at times, I thought, well, maybe God is calling him. This is wonderful. Come on up. Come up for the weekend. So he came to see me on the Monday after being in St. Andrews, and he said, David, I can't do it. I said, why not? He says, there's nothing for my family. I said, what do you mean? Like, no youth group for my kids. And no, I said, that's because there's nobody. Someone has to be first. Someone has to be the first child. Someone. But what we found is this. I was 18 years in St. Peter's before one Christian family came to us. Because Christian families wanted to go to churches where there were programs and stuff for their kids and everything else. And we basically just bred our own, almost literally. They said you can't, build a church from students. Well, we did, in some ways, and also backslidden Christians, and a lot of single people. But Christian families, evangelical ones I'm talking about, wanted the whole package. They liked the talk about evangelism. They liked the talk about the gospel. But unless there was the whole package, and what you end up doing is churches often end up catering for these families. Its most extreme level I've seen in the United States, where I was going down a road one time, and there, you know, it's one of these roads in, I think it was in Memphis, and there was like a big church, and then a bigger church, and then an even bigger church, and then an even bigger church. And I'm going, this is like Churchville. So all these churches. And I said to the pastor I was with, like that one, what's that one? And he says, oh, that's an Anglican one. I said, there must be about like 1,000 people in there. He says, no, about 250, 300. I said, how is it that big? He says, well, they've got a basketball court, and they've got offices, and they've got a school, and they've got, and he listed all. I said, what do they need all that for? He said, because if they don't have it, then their families will go to the Baptists. Or, and what the churches were doing were competing with one another in terms of facilities to attract Christians. And that's just wrong. One of the biggest problems I've faced in Dundee is the continual competition between churches. And that's not radical Christianity. That's market Christianity. That's consumer Christianity. And even those of us who condemn consumer Christianity, we practice it. We've got to stop it. You know, you're not going to grow a church unless you're going to accept that as the Lord works, bad stuff's going to happen and people are going to leave, as well as people being converted and people coming in. And then relational. By definition, I mean, that's my one concession to any millennials here, we'll use the word relational. But it just means you get on with each other. When I'm standing preaching my first Sunday, and there's 15 people, including my mother-in-law and my family and everything. And my mother-in-law was a very, very good evangelist, because the guy who was decorating the manse said, she was talking to him, and he said, do you believe in God? Oh, aye, he says, I'm a Buddhist, Feloki, and I read the Quran. I'm going, oh, my goodness. And she just looked at him and said, she wasn't having none of it. She says, well, you need to get down to the church and hear about Jesus. And she just kept nagging him. I mean, he was painting. He was trying to get through it as quick as possible, but she made him work anyway. And he came. And he didn't realize in church you're not supposed to speak. So you've got this church that sits 750. You've got pews, and you've got people dotted around, not really sitting next to each other, certainly not sitting at the front. And at the end of the service, he stands up and he looks around at everyone. I'll do it in Scots first. He says, yous people dinna ken each other, eh? Yous need to do something. You need to have a cup of tea or something. You know, yous need to get to know each other. And I was going, which basically, you can understand that. You know, you people don't know each other. You need to get to know each other and all that. And I thought, you know what, Lord, thank you so much. From that day on, we've always had tea and coffee after the service. People don't leave. They just don't. I mean, it's ridiculous. We're now doing tea and coffee for 300 people. And it's a real pain. You know, go home. Get your lunch. Go away. But he was right. You know, he saw it. There's something missing. We're singing about loving Jesus and being together with one another. And I'm sorry, but, you know, giving one another a handshake and a wee hug at the end, you know, turn to the person beside you and hug them. Not in my culture, you're not doing that. Not unless you want to get decked. It's just, no. I mean, that may be your culture, fine, you go hug. But it's just getting to know people. It really is being relational. I'll give you another example. Man comes up to me after service, and he said, David, that was just brilliant. So I'm an egotistical person, and I thought, oh, you enjoyed the sermon? No. I said, well, what are you talking about? He says, the letter. What letter? He says, oh, man, that's even better. That you weren't doing it to show off. And I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. And then it hit me, I did know what he was talking about. We started this thing just because some woman had an idea and it was a great idea. And I'm always saying, if you get an idea, just go for it. And if it works, fine. If it doesn't work, you're a Calvinist, who cares? So the Lord is sovereign. So she had this idea, when someone has a baby, because we had no babies and then we started having babies, we were really productive. And when someone has a baby, why don't we provide meals? So now everyone in the congregation who has a baby, and I think they're getting pregnant to get this actually, they get 2 weeks of free meals provided by the congregation. And there was this couple who already had two under fives, and they had twins. And I did feel for them, you know, but people provided meals for 2 weeks. And they wrote a letter, and I just thought, you know, instead of putting it in the church news bulletin or something, I'll just read it out. So I read it out. And this guy said to me, I don't know any group that does that. He says, this is amazing. This is amazing. And he says, I want to hear what you've got to say because of that. Now, the trouble is, don't turn that into a methodology. Don't say we're going to do that in order to show that we're amazing. No, you do these things. Like, you play table tennis with kids because it's good to play table tennis and because you like the kids. You do not play table tennis with kids with a penalty being that they have to listen to the gospel. You know, they get it for free, but they have to listen to the gospel. In our youth work at one time, we realized this was what was happening, that the kids were thinking, listening to the gospel is the price we pay for coming to this club. So what we did was we started saying, right, we're done, go home. Oh, you're not doing the Bible? Yeah, but that's for us, not for you. Oh, can't we stay? No, you wouldn't like it. And they were all desperate to stay, so you got to be relational. Okay. Who needs theology when we have Christ? So for me, what we've done in our culture, we are far more infected by the culture than we realize. And our culture compartmentalizes everything. So in our churches, you get people saying, well, our church is really into worship. What they mean is sung praise. Or, we're really into preaching. What they mean is a biblical lecture. Or, we're really into mercy ministries. Or, we're really into overseas evangelism. Sorry, these are not hobbies. And they're not options. If you're to be a biblical church, then these things have got to be for real. And theology is one thing. How do you evangelize without theology? How do you tell people to believe in Jesus if they don't know who Jesus is? And so we're constantly telling people about who Jesus is. And it's not that easy. You know, I'm Sinclair Ferguson, who's some of you may have heard, he's my assistant, and, you know, he's coming on quite well. You know, we're teaching him to chill a wee bit, I should shut up with that. Actually, one guy came up to me. See, in Scotland, and maybe this is the same in the United Kingdom overall, there's no famous Christians. So in America, like, there was what we call Sinclair groupies. But in Scotland, our people hadn't a clue who Sinclair was, especially the younger people. I remember one guy coming up to me after, and just an awesome sermon. And he said, "Hey, Dave, you better watch yourself. The old boy's pretty good." So he's stunning. But let me tell you this. Sinclair preaches theology, and theology is about Jesus. He preaches the Bible. And I have, like last Sunday, I had a guy who'd never been in church before, lapped every single bit of it up. And you get people who've been Christians for years and years and saying, "Oh, come on, keep it simple." No, keep it clear. Keep it clear. Don't jargonize, but tell them about Christ. And what should happen when people are told about Christ is they should get a sense of the just sheer wonder of Jesus. You know, so you need, how do you evangelize without theology? I don't think it's evangelism. And, you know, how do you theologize without evangelism? How can you read books? I mean, for me, I'd put it this way. Sinclair's got me into John Owen, and I really like John Owen. But you know what John Owen did for me? I was on a sabbatical in Australia, and I said, and this may seem the strangest person, I just sit and read in, I can't remember, volume 6 or volume 7 or whatever. And it just, I hadn't, just one of those moments, I said, do you know, all I want to do is tell people about Jesus. I don't want to tell people about John Owen. I certainly don't want to use his language. But I want to tell them about the Jesus that I've just been reading about in this book. You know, and that's the kind of passion you're wanting to create. I like football, which is really, really bad for me because I'm Scottish and Scotland haven't been in the World Cup since, I don't know, England last won one. So I thought I'd get that in first. And I support Dundee, but I'm like one of these guys that has a wee Ford Fiesta, and on the back it says, "My other car's a Porsche." Well, my other team's Barcelona. And one day Barcelona came to play Dundee United, and I went to see them, and I remember halfway through the second half, Barcelona were winning 4-0, and just the whole stadium just stood up and applauded them. It was just incredible. I got on the bus to go home, and this is how I describe it. I couldn't care less if you were a little old lady who could only speak Serbo-Croat and doing your knitting. I was going to tell you about what I'd just seen because I was so excited. You need people to be walking out of your church so excited about what they've heard that they have to shut up. They don't need to be goaded into, "Oh, I better do some evangelism now." But let me tell you about it. Let me tell you about it. You want the gospel. In Glasgow and in Dundee, they would talk about, when they had launderettes, they called it a steamy. And this was days pre-mobile phones. And you'd go, and basically, a washing machine or a tumble dryer is really not all that exciting to watch. So you'd have to talk to people. And then that's what became the gossip place. And so the phrase became, "What's the talk of the steamy?" You want the gospel to be the talk of the steamy. I heard some people talking at a bus stop one time. It was just brilliant. And they were just talking about the church and St. Peter's, and they were talking about Jesus, and I thought, this is wonderful. And there was another time I was in a wee cafe restaurant, and I was talking to a friend. We were sitting having a coffee, and we were talking about Jesus. We weren't shouting. We weren't trying to witness. And this guy goes, he taps on our table, and he says, "You people, I hate you people." Okay, thanks. I'll report you for hate speech. You're going to jail, mate. But then I realized, you know, people do listen in. Be careful on that, by the way. I've heard some dreadful gossip between Christians in a cafe that non-Christians hear. It puts them off enormously. And you don't need to do it fake. You can do it for real. Like there was an Irish Catholic lady, very brilliant lady, who was converted, and she said, "Can I meet you for a coffee and stuff?" So I went out, and we went in this wee tea room place. And she says, "Dave, I don't get the Old Testament." I said, "Why not?" She says, "Well, look, this is what happens in the Old Testament. God calls the Israelites, and he blesses them, and he warns them. And then they turn away from him, and they screw up, and he punishes them. And then he calls them back. And then he does it again, and they do it again, and they do it again. And then she went, those damn Israelites. And I went, okay. And I thought, that's actually a pretty accurate summation of the Old Testament. But what got me was the whole Kathy was listening. And I had to answer. You know? And well, who knows? You use theology. Some people say, I follow Christ, not the church. I hate that. Because Christ died for the church. So how are you following him? You know, you should break your heart if the church is a mess. And the church is usually a mess. I basically just start on the basis that a church is a family. And my view is that there are no normal families in the world. That every family is dysfunctional and every church is to some degree or other dysfunctional. But Christ is present with his church and the church is beautiful. And so when people say, I follow Christ, not the church, I say, you're not following Christ. You know, it's Augustine's famous phrase, isn't it? That he who does not have the church for his mother does not have God for his father. I'm not talking about denominationalism. I'll do anything to win people for Jesus. No, you won't, and nor should you. One big evangelist guy in the city center in Dundee, standing there yelling verses from the King James Version at people passing in the street, no one listening. So I went up to him and said, look, I admire your courage. It takes courage to do this. But is this the best way to go? And he said, yeah, I'm preaching the word of God. And I said, yeah, but nobody's listening. He said, yeah, but, you know, God's word won't return to him void. He had everything. I said, I know, but this is a bit daft. He says, no, it doesn't matter as long as it's the word of God. I said, okay, I'm going to give you a challenge. He said, okay. I said, I want you to strip naked and run around this square shouting John 3:16. I'll guarantee you'll get noticed. And he said, oh, but that's crazy. I said, exactly. That's what I'm trying to say. You know, why do we associate evangelism with eccentricity? Because sometimes lone evangelists can be eccentric. And a little bit of eccentricity isn't necessarily bad. But I'm playing football on the meadows in Edinburgh when I was a student. All non-Christians playing with me. And then they stopped me and they said, hey, Dave, you better go talk to that guy over there. Which one? The guy's preaching at the end of the meadows. He's one of your lot. I went, oh, dear, right. So I did. I went down and said, excuse me, what are you doing? He says, I'm preaching the word of God. I said, forgive me saying this, but there's nobody here. There's nobody. I said, the nearest people are me and my mates playing football, and we can't hear you. What are you doing? He says, ah, well, the godly Spurgeon was once preaching, and there was a man up a tree who was converted. At that moment, I decided never to become a Baptist. Sorry. I said, you're seriously preaching in the hope that there's someone up a tree. What do you do? It's no wonder people, you know, that just doesn't make any sense. Listen, I'm not against open-air preaching at all, by the way. I think you can do it if you've got a microphone and so on, but don't think you're George Whitfield. He could preach to 10,000 because there was no tires. There's no cars. There was no noise. And I'm sorry, but someone standing yelling at people in the street, it's not great evangelism. So when you say, I'll do anything to win people for Jesus, I wouldn't, don't do anything. Do what Jesus says. And in particular, pray, of course. Some misplaced strategies, seeker-friendly churches. Now, by definition, every church has to be seeker-friendly in that you have to welcome people. I'm often accused of being homophobic. I think one of my favorite letters was from an LGBT activist who wrote a paper in Scotland saying, if I wanted to anything, it would be by David Robertson's Christianity. He said, I've been to his church and people treated me with respect. Well, because our theology tells us that all human beings are made in the image of God. Whether it's the person lying in the gutter or the person wallowing in their own sexual sin or whatever it is, our churches should be welcoming to people. But seeker-friendly has come to mean we need to provide a church which will make non-Christians feel comfortable when they come. I don't want non-Christians to feel comfortable. I'm not going to make pews hard to make them feel uncomfortable. But I really want, I'm going to give you one example. Up in the Highlands, where I was a minister for 6 years, there was an oil rig worker came for the first time, and he came out and he's standing at the door and he looked at me, he's really angry, and he said, you just come to my house to get information about me, to preach about me. And I said, whoa, back off. I didn't know you were going to be here, and I don't prepare my sermons last minute, even though it may appear like that. You know, I said, do you know this? Honestly, if that got to you, it was God speaking to you. Well, he was so freaked out that he started running down the road from the church. And my old elder, who wouldn't say boo to a goose, shouted out after him, Aye, you can run, but you can't hide. I thought, oh, yeah, you can run, but you can't hide. You know? I've got used to get people getting up and walking out of sermons, walking out of churches, being very uncomfortable. When God's at work, you're going to feel very uncomfortable. And a lot of Christians are going to feel very uncomfortable. I had experienced myself a couple of weeks ago of being very convicted by my own sermon. And I just wanted out the place. I wanted to repent. So seeker-friendly churches is, to me, it's just always artificial. Make sure your church is a loving church that welcomes people and weeps for people. Evangelism programs. Now, I have to be careful here. I just don't like programs. And I think the problem with evangelism, I'm the only person I know who's failed evangelism explosion because I went and did the course in the States and I kept failing it because I didn't follow what they said. And I just, the programmatic approach just reminds me of the Jehovah's Witnesses. Now, the advantage of evangelism programs is it teaches Christians the Bible and they memorize scriptures. Perhaps it gives a framework to help, but the trouble is you're not dealing with frames, you're dealing with people. And, you know, I struggled with Alpha because they wouldn't let us adapt it. You had to follow it exactly. Christianity Explored, I loved, because when I spoke to Rico Tice, he says, do with it whatever you want, change it however you like. I thought, good, that's my kind of program. So we did. We ended up not using it in a group, we ended up using it one-to-one. You know, there's a whole bunch of different things. But I'm not saying don't use programs, but I'm saying don't rely on them. If you have to rely on a program, it's a bit like a marriage program, isn't it? You know, if you really have to rely on a program, it could be helpful, you know, to help you with your partner. But if you have to rely on a program, there's something wrong. And we can talk about that in a minute. Friendship evangelism. That's what I mean by when people say, well, I'm going to be friends with people in order that I can convert them. I'm sorry, but that's manipulation. And that is the love bombing thing. I've got friends. I mean, I once baptized a 99-year-old. You've got to be patient. You're friends with people because you like them. Do you know that there are Christians I don't like and there are Christians who don't like me? Well, get over it. You know, that's just the way it is. But there are people you like. But I think to pretend to like someone in order to evangelize them, it's not good because when it doesn't work, what you tend to do is drop them. And if you truly like and love someone, you'll never drop them. You know, so it's, again, just think as a methodology. Some questions, and then we'll have some questions. How's your church structured? I think that's really important. Evangelism's got to be part of the DNA. Most churches I know, including my own, and I still think this is true of my own, we've become more like this, and maybe we'll look at this in the session in the afternoon about if your church grows, and as it grows, and I would expect it to grow, how do you deal with that? And one of the problems is DNA. Evangelism was written into the DNA of our church. When you've got a handful of people, and you're going to close in 6 months, no Christian's going to come to you, really. You can't build your church by... So it's got to grow by evangelism. But really, you're only going to do evangelism because your church is dying? You should be doing evangelism because the world's dying and because you love the world. And I'm really disappointed at how many larger churches are primarily geared towards attracting those who are Christians. And I want to say this as well, for those of you involved in church planting, a friend of mine who's very involved in that in London, but he's very cynical. And he calls it church repotting often, where people don't get a church that they particularly like. They come out of university, they've been in a CU, they go to an area where the church isn't as they'd like it to be, so let's church plant. I think there's more church plants in my area that have risen out of church splits than out of a desire to reach the lost. And God can use that, of course he can. But really? So think about how your church is structured and who it's structured for. That is important. Think about what evangelism takes place in and through your church. Is evangelism in most churches, I think it's for a specialist group. And it should be the DNA of your church. It should filter through in everything, in your leadership meetings. You know, we're at one service and we're quite full. Well, are we going to go to two services? What do people talk about? They talk about money. They talk about what it's going to cost. They talk about... in terms of time, they talk about the effort, they talk about, oh, we'll no longer feel like a family. But what I want to talk about is the non-Christian family that comes into the church that's pretty well full and they don't get a seat. They don't like that. Christians love the buzz, but they often don't like it. So how is my church geared to reach non-Christians? And how inward-looking are we? What evangelism does actually take place? Does your church grow through people coming from other churches or conversion growth? Now, here's a problem. Once you start seeing conversion growth, you'll also start getting more people from other churches because they like the life. And don't turn them away. But you should never aim to grow from attracting people from other biblical churches. Non-biblical churches, wipe them out as far as I'm concerned. You know, we've got loads of liberals come to our church, and it's great. I love it. And so that's fine. But the idea, I mean, we went through a stage for about a year. I made a big mistake. I let somebody turn our evening service into a student service with a specific aim of attracting students who were already Christians. That was his aim. So we become the student church. I kidded myself, well, that means we'll grow and be able to do more evangelism. But after a year, we stopped it. Because what we were doing is we were taking from Central Baptist and we were taking from other churches. And actually, our non-Christians and our older people weren't coming. My son's doing a church plant in this very poor area. Lots of people want to, can we come and help you? Can we come and help you? Can we? And he's saying, no, not unless you're prepared to come and live in the community and not because you're unhappy with your church and not because it's cool to be helping the poor or anything like that. He says, actually, at the end of the day, I want people in this community to be converted for the leadership to come from them, for them to own it. And that's a longer term work. But good for him. It's not the way I would have done it, but I really admire him for doing that. If your church is not going to grow through conversion growth, what's the point? You can have a full and successful church, and all you've done, there's a church I know I went and did some work in Northern Ireland, there's no necessarily to name it. And there's a church there that's growing and flourishing and fantastic and cited in lots of Christian magazines. But a lot of the evangelical churches around, they have no young families left because they've all gone to this church. Well, how's that helping the witness? You know, there's a problem. Members, adherents, and contacts. I don't know how you think about this. Members in your church are people who are committed believers. Adherents are people who might not be that committed or may not even be believers, but they come along, they associate. But the one I'm interested in is, who are the contacts? Where are you going to get your adherents from? You know, who are the non-Christians? In fact, one day sit down and draw up a list of how many non-Christians and think about who's in your church. Reaching out, simple mantra I like, contact. How do you meet non-Christians? That's why it's okay to do music concerts. And one of the great things we've had is five-a-side football. But you don't have to create a church environment to do all of that. Just how do you meet non-Christians? And sometimes you have to shut down some of the church meetings because you've got Christians who are constantly at church meetings. They never meet non-Christians. Connect. What do you have in common? How do you connect with people? I always think like that. What's the connection I've got here? My wife gave me a row last week because we went to the IFES conference and I was speaking at it, and everyone I met, there was 40 European countries, didn't matter, Belarus, Kazakhstan, I knew their country. You know, I said, oh, I've read a history of your country, because I was always looking, and I have, I read a lot of history, but I'm always looking for a point to connect. I think that's really, really important. We had this old minister from the Scottish Highlands, you know, dog collar all the time type guy. And he spoke with this very theological language, and I thought, you know, one day a Norwegian punk came in, you know, the whole goth thing, then, you know, the rings in nose and ears and eyebrows and everything. And I saw Murdy, the dog collar and all, speaking to him. I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I got to hear this conversation. And this actually happened. Murdy went, oh, well, lovely to see you. How is your soul? And the Norwegian went, I think they're fine. You know, and I thought, this is a train wreck of how not to do evangelism. Let me tell you something. The next Sunday, the Norwegian came in and said, where's the old man? I said, that's interesting. Why do you want to see him? He says, do you know, he asked about my grandmother. And this Sunday, when I came in the morning, he told me he'd been praying for my grandmother all week. And I just thought, that was a real connection. You know, get a connection. And communicate. You've got to communicate the gospel. What's the point in people saying, oh, they're really, really nice if you don't communicate the gospel? I'm struggling just now because my neighbors are Muslim and we've got a good connection with them in some ways, but I know I haven't communicated the gospel. And I'm just not sure. There's an open door, I think, in our culture. We'll say more about this tomorrow. There's a philosophical marketplace that's open. I think there's a huge amount of witness that can be done through work. Not walking in with a big Bible and preaching at people. But there's a lot of connections there. I do like Metzger's The Whole Christ. The whole Christ, the whole person. Sinclair's book, by the way, on the whole Christ, on the marrow controversy. That's what I mean about theology. You read that book, and if you don't want to tell people about that Jesus, then I'm sorry, I doubt you're converted, and you certainly shouldn't be in the ministry, because it's just wonderful. It's the whole Christ. We have got so much to offer in Jesus. Chinese girl comes to our church, never ever been in church before, never ever read the Bible. Does Christianity Explored. Second time, halfway through, tears pouring down her face. I said, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" "Yes," she said, I'm fine. I'm fine." I said, "Why are you crying?" She said, "Jesus, he's so beautiful. He's so beautiful." Yeah. She became a Christian, went off and joined the Baptists. You win some, you lose some. No. I am very, very happy. I mean, I had an elder complain once, "David, all these people are coming in here being converted and going elsewhere. Doesn't that bother you?" And I said, "No, not really. Let God is going to bless. Let's just get on with it. The whole Christ to the whole person. Use the Bible, use prayer, use the church." To me, that's what evangelism is. I don't see how you do evangelism without the Bible. I don't see how you do evangelism without prayer. And I don't see how you do evangelism without the church. Just some final questions. To what extent do you think the members of your church have an adequate understanding of the gospel? How equipped are they to communicate it? Please do not presuppose that you know the answer to that until you talk to them. You need to find that out. How do you think you could equip your church to be evangelists? You know the mantra, don't you? You've got a congregation of 100. Let's say 60, 70 of them are believers. They're going out to be witnesses in the world. How are you equipping them? That's why apologetics, inverted commas, is not just for specialists from professors and all that kind of stuff. They need to know answers. You need to equip them. What are the dangers we can see in encouraging people to go into all the world? I've seen far too many students stumble and fall because they thought they were witnessing by not going to church on Sunday and playing in the ultimate frisbee team. What are the dangers of the Christian ghetto mentality? I grew up in the Christian Brethren, so I've seen that as well. But I've also seen it in different ways. We hide away. Where's the lost people? There are the lost who go to church. Plenty of people in your church who are not really believers. There are people who visit occasionally. Well, I would guess I'm calling the loose adherents. And there are people who are never in a month of Sundays would I go to church. You know what we found? People won't go to church, but we found some come to a prayer meeting with a guy converted through just coming to prayer meetings. We make sure that people are welcome. The sacraments, I think, are important. I think baptism and the Lord's Supper are very, very important symbols in terms of evangelism. And I think, as I said already, the community and conversion are absolutely crucial. Church planning and community churches and building-based evangelism, preaching, getting out, worship, beyond the borders, you know, getting out. Just get out and tell people about Jesus. List the ways your church is reaching the lost. List the additional ways you think you could. And well, I think I asked that question already. I'll leave it there. And we've got a wee while for questions or comments. But you'll gather from what I've been saying that I just think the potential of the church in the United Kingdom to reach the lost, that's what I'm really wanting to encourage. And I do think that so many of us have become really discouraged because we haven't seen conversions. And I have an absolute conviction. I mean, when I was in Edinburgh Uni, I was an Arminian without knowing what an Arminian was. I mean, I really did think it was a country. And I had no idea. I just thought, I've got to save these people. And I ran around like a headless chicken trying to save people. And then I became a Calvinist without knowing what Calvin was. I thought, you know, Calvin was a guy who drowned a Baptist once. You know, and that was, I knew nothing, very, very little about it, but I came to believe in the sovereignty of God. And long before I read J.I. Packer's Evangelism and the Sovereignty of God, which is such a great book, I just believed this. I believed if God was sovereign and God had given his word and God has said his word wouldn't return to him void, every time I communicated that word, there would be fruit. I also believed it was normal for churches to grow. It's abnormal for churches not to grow. Sometimes they won't. I accept that. I know that. I know what Don was saying last night is right. But overall, I think you've got to expect growth. It is like the farmer. I'm planting seed. I'm expecting to see a crop. I think a lot of us have, although not in theology, become hyper-Calvinists, in practice we've become hyper-Calvinists. And dare I say it, we've even become like a church I know in the United States where I looked on their membership board. They welcome new members. And it was a Presbyterian church. And in a month, 38 new members. Transfer from such and such Baptist. Transfer from such and such Baptist. Transfer from such and such Baptist. Usually Baptist. And I said, guys, what is this? And they said, well, they're good at reaching people and then we're good at discipling them. And I said, no, this is wrong. Your theology is wrong. That this cannot be right. You can't be good at discipling if you're not reaching people with the gospel. You cannot rely on Pentecostals and charismatics to reach people with the gospel and then arrogantly say, and then we'll teach them the way of God more perfectly. You know, it's not like they come in at entry league and then you're, you know, Premier League. If you're a biblical church, one of the primary things about being a biblical church is that you reach out. I'd like to say I know how to do it. I don't. Those are just some ideas. We try, and, you know, God has blessed, and I absolutely believe that God will always bless his word, and that's why, even with all the hassles and troubles, we're in such a privileged position to be able to give people the word of life. So, any questions or comments before we go for coffee? Oh, the microphone. That's a good idea, yeah. Do you want to act as my beautiful assistant? There's a gentleman right at the back. So if you run around there, and then if someone over here can ask one, and then we'll just keep going. And if you could say your name as well, that'd be great.
Yeah, my name's John. Hi, John. Just wanted to ask a question about training your church in evangelism, yeah. Best ways to do that.
Okay. Number one, I think, if for church leadership, is example. Number two is, I think, preaching. They need to see it in the preaching. Number three, I would suggest, is hospitality. I also think small groups are essential in that, especially if you're in a larger church. And another thing is, for me, in evangelism, I think we've got permission, just try things. Like, I was joking about the silver bullet last night, but I wasn't joking about having lots of them. I have an armory full of bullets. Some of them are duds, but you don't know they're duds until you shoot them. So encourage people to try. I mean, we had a German lady who came. She was converted from an almost Islamic background. She was a vegan, uber fit. You must think this is the weirdest congregation in the world, but that's what happens. God attracts weird people to weird people. And she said to me, David, I'd really want to do something in the church. I want to help. I want to help with the evangelism and different things. And I said, well, what do you do? She said, well, apart from being a lecturer in sociology, she said, I like ballroom dancing. And she said, I'd like to start the dance group. Now, this was a free church at that point. We were Psalms only, a cappella music. We've changed since then. But I said, haven't you noticed that we don't have a dance group? And I just thought a dance group to a cappella Psalms would be quite something. And she said, oh, no, I know, but I thought I could start it. And I said, no. And she looked chestfallen. I said, you know what I want you to do? I want you to teach ballroom dancing. She said, what? Teach ballroom dancing in our hall. Lots of the young guys will want to learn. I didn't know it would work, and she did. Sold out. And so many people came in. It was a contact event. I'm not saying it was evangelism, but it was a contact event. And she said, I cannot believe that I'm going to be allowed to teach board. I thought everything has to be worship. And I'm going, no, not here. We just ain't going there, you know. And I think what I'm saying with that is encourage people just to do things. And if they don't work, give them permission to fail. They always think, what if it's not successful? What if it's not? So I think by example, by preaching, and yes, I do think using Christianity Explored is very useful, or Discipleship Explored, or Life Explored. It's very useful for helping Christians to see the big picture, as well as non-Christians. So yeah, sorry, carry on. There's a comeback. And then
I just wondered, would you ever do anything like this with them? Like take a Saturday and do something like this as well?
Yeah, my view is that if you can, sometimes I would have a Q&A thing or whatever. But I tell you, you know, a great thing, one thing that's universal in every culture is food. So hospitality. I mean, it's not rocket science, Alpha and Christianity Explored, having a meal and talking about the Bible. So, but I think a lot of our people don't have confidence to talk about the Bible. And so we have to help them without formularizing them. Do you know what I mean? So sometimes I think it's good to have, you know, let's think about some of the discussions that your friends have. Here's a bizarre thing. We've probably had more non-Christians come and hear the gospel through... I don't often do topical sermons, but maybe once every 3 months. So, say, one on abortion. I did one on transgender. And, I mean, the danger is not to turn these into political things. But for me, they're always gospel opportunities once you go into the deeper issues. But also when that happens, you're training your own people to see... My view is there's a way to connect everybody or every subject to the gospel. You know, and people learn by seeing, they learn by doing, they learn by hearing. So thank you. Anyone else want to ask anything? There's a gentleman over here. Oh, this is good for you, Andy. Where? There. Can you bring some lights on so I can see?
He's in darkness. My name's John as well. I was just wondering, so like somebody who doesn't believe in God, how do you share the gospel with them? How do you open up a conversation about that?
Well, first of all, you beat them to a pulp. Someone who doesn't believe in God. I just think, I mean, what you don't immediately do normally is go into the, you know, the five theistic proofs or all that kind of stuff. You can't argue. Nor, by the way, do you go on the assumption saying, well, of course you believe in God, you're just lying. Because I think that's a bit too much in terms of assuming what you know. If someone says to me, just a very simple thing, say, I don't believe in God. I say, that's interesting. Tell me about this God you don't believe in. I go, what? So for me, I always go left field. What do you mean this God you don't believe in? I say, well, tell me. I don't believe in a God that does this, a God that does that. Well, I said, neither do I. Now let me tell you about the God I do believe in. And so I would challenge it at an intellectual level. I'd also ask why. One of the key things with questions is not immediately to give an answer. That's one of the dangers, by the way, of the training thing. If you say, here's the answer to this. Actually, no, you want to find out what the question is. So someone says, I don't believe in God, and I say, okay, why? Why don't you believe in God? What's happened? And sometimes it's a bad religious experience. Sometimes it's a lack of evidence. Sometimes it's the way they've been indoctrinated in school. So you're just finding out. And then the other thing I would say is, most people won't be quite militantly atheist, but they will be agnostic. I don't know if there's a God or not. And I think you've got to challenge people to be intelligent agnostics. So the way I do that is I just simply say, oh, you're an agnostic. Are you a dumb one or an intelligent one? let me explain the difference. I'm in my house. I'm watching Barcelona playing Real Madrid. They're winning 7-0 after 10 minutes and the European Cup final. You come and knock on my door and you say, did you know your house is on fire? And I say, no, I didn't know that. I'm an agnostic. You know, but if I'm a dumb agnostic, I say, get lost. I don't like you. You look weird. I don't believe my house is on fire anyway. I'm enjoying the game too much. I'm going to sit and watch it. But an intelligent agnostic says, do you know this? It's a big deal if my house burns down, especially if I'm in it. So I'm going to go and check. And I would always get to people and say, listen, you say you don't believe in God, but you really need to look. You really need to investigate. And I think that's the most you can do. And say, look, you don't believe in God. Why not come along to church and just have a look for yourselves? So I often say to people, take 6 weeks, no commitment, no obligation. I mean, they always think you're after your money and they're trying to get you to join a cult. I had a guy come and says, Dave, I want to join the church, but like, I don't believe in Jesus or any of that stuff. I said, that's a big deal in this church. And I says, no, you can't. And his face fell. And I says, but you can come to everything. You don't have to belong to the church to come to the services. You can come along to the Wednesday fellowship meal and things like that. Really? And you don't want my money? No. Wow. You know, Scotland, obviously, so I don't want to. You know, I think that is really, really important. Really important. Just challenge people gently. And it's where they're coming from. I mean, I can't offer a formula for that because sometimes you do get occasionally aggressive militant atheists. So I just tend to be just as aggressive back to them. That soon sorts them. Right. We'll take a couple more and then we'll be done. Gentleman in front.
Yeah. Hi, Warren.
Warren.
You mentioned give people freedom to fail. Could you give any examples of maybe small or even epic fails?
Oh, yeah.
That's sometimes helpful for us to hear that, because you think...
Yeah, you know. I mean, I've had some absolutely massive epic fails personally, and so it helps others when they do it. You know, on a wide scale, I started a magazine that I thought would reach the UK, and it failed. So, you know, I still think it was the right thing to do, but you can fail in that. One of the problems I find is you offer to go and speak at a church and do an outreach event in a cafe, and inevitably about a week beforehand, the pastor will phone you and say, look, I'm not sure how many people are coming, but I'm phoning around. And I have to say to him, stop it, please don't phone around. Don't get your Christian friends to come. I don't care if it's 10 people, if 5 of them are non-Christians. I just, seriously. So, I mean, I've gone, I thought an event, the outreach that we did one time, and I went in and there was nobody there. It's pretty disheartening for yourself and for you. One of the big epic things is sometimes seed looks as though it's fallen on good ground and people receive the word with rejoicing. And you put them up as epic converts. And then a year later, they're pronouncing themselves as atheists. That's happened. You know, epic fails is when I saw somebody, I thought, this guy's really, really gifted. I'd like to see, you know, he ended up committing adultery and just turned, you know, and it was my responsibility because I took him on too quickly. You know, I didn't. So you will fail in so many things. But there was a guy, a Rangers football player, English guy called Mark Hatley, and Rangers were playing Leeds in the European Cup one time, and Hatley scored an outrageous goal that, you know, if he meant it, he'd be Messi, you know, and he didn't mean it. I mean, he lied, but he just belted it, and he volleyed it into the back of the net at Elland Road from some ridiculous distance, and afterwards, they were trying to get him to say he didn't mean it, and he gave a great line. He says, if you don't buy a ticket, you can't win the lottery. And do you know this? Maybe that's not the greatest line for evangelism. So don't yeah. But it is. It is. You know, just try things. You know, I think you will find something in your context and in your culture that just really works. You didn't realize it would work. You stumbled across it. My biggest fear is of people not trying because they're scared of failing. Or people trying, thinking they're going to do it in their own strength, but trying because you believe God is sovereign and God can bless even your stupid efforts is wonderful. The other thing is, just from my perspective, in my denomination, we're dreadfully slow at starting things. We're even worse at stopping them. Stop things. We had a youth club at one point, and to call it a failure wouldn't be fair. I think 40 to 50 teenagers over the years heard the gospel. I don't think it was a failure. I don't know any who became believers through it, but I don't think it was a failure because the word was put out. But there came a point when we said, no, we're done with this. We're stopping. It's taking up too much of our energy. You know, there's a time you shake the dust off your feet. So there's loads, but one more and then we're done. Okay, there's a gentleman at the back there. And then.
Thanks. My name's Chris. How would you encourage and advise a Christian introvert?
I would say, look at me. A Christian introvert. I'll tell you how I would encourage. There's a guy I knew who could hardly speak to anyone. And I'm standing at a graveside up in the Highlands, burying a young man, big group of people at the graveside. And this guy who never said boo to a goose came up to the family and he just looked at them and he said, look up. And I know his words had phenomenal impact. So I would say to them, don't think that God uses people just because they're extroverts. You know, I'm not an extrovert, but I do speak a lot, and I speak in public. And people think, oh, I've got to do that. Actually, the vast majority of witness will be one-to-one, and B, with people you know. So I don't care. Extrovert, introvert, it doesn't matter. Are you praying for opportunities to tell people about Jesus, and are you always ready to give an answer or a reason for the hope that you have? An introvert will tell, you know, if a building's on fire, the introvert doesn't go, I'm an introvert, I can't go and tell people. And let me tell you this, if an introvert won the lottery, he'd still tell people. So it's more, the answer to your question to me is more, how do I encourage everyone? And incidentally, one of the things I need to do is encourage extroverts not to talk about themselves. That's my biggest danger, you know, because all my illustrations and stuff, well, they're the ones that I know best. But then you end up talking about yourself all the time. And you don't want people to see you. You want people to see Jesus. So again, I'll just encourage you. Thank you for being here. And please let me encourage you in this. Please do not regard the norm as our churches won't grow by evangelism, by outreach. That is how the church grows. And God's called you to wherever you are. It's God's word, and you're sowing it. Let him bring the results. That's the freedom of the biblical evangelist. God bless you. Enjoy your coffee.
Thank you, David.